Dave, you say that the jet being on the runway here makes turning back a non-starter. So let's take the jet off the runway, take that out of the picture. And then you say you'd still not turn back because you're below the altitude that you briefed. And I want to know, is it the right thing to do because it's what you briefed? Or is it the right thing to do just objectively from this situation?
It's the right thing to do objectively. I mean, it's a really tough set of circumstances. It's a really bad hand that this pilot has been dealt. But I just keep coming back to touching down at the lowest possible ground speed. And that means into the wind. And so the one thing that's in this pilot's favor is a strong wind that he can point the plane into to minimize the ground speed at impact. And so that, to me, should be paramount in this pilot's mind.
Yeah, and everybody else is in agreement with you here. Nobody else, at least, is turning back for the runway. Would anybody have briefed this differently and having briefed it differently, have done anything differently?
Well, the only thing I would say about this is, yeah, you've done this experiment, you've practiced this scenario, but in any of these engine failure right after takeoff situations, they are always dependent on the very specific circumstances. What's the wind? Where did you depart? How long is the runway you departed from? And so, yeah, the experiments you did with, 900 feet will just barely make it back. That worked that day or those days that you practiced it, but not necessarily this day in these circumstances. You have to be very, very careful about really assuming that you can do it just because you practiced it. The circumstances on this day are what really matter.
Paul, you're also not turning back for the runway. So I'm curious if that's because the briefing said you wouldn't or because it's objectively what you should do.
Objectively, because the briefings, you brief these things and what you brief is not necessarily what you see. So sometimes you just have to make a snap decision that's different than what you briefed. I mean, we can all sit in our office chairs here and say, no, you got to be disciplined and stick to your briefing. But when you're actually in the airplane, circumstances intervene that make it different. So looking out the window here, objectively, I mean, I have a reason for picking the road, but it's essentially the same reason as the field. It's more or less aligned with the direction of flight, and it's into the wind.
Yeah, this summer, I was literally just walking around town, and I came across an Amphib 172 on a road. And it turns out that they, I don't know what exactly led to it, but they, engine out, landed on a road, and there are a bunch of fields, what looked like perfectly good fields surrounding that road. So it's not to question that pilot's decision that I wasn't there for, but roads definitely have a strong pull. It's pavement.
Well, I can put some numbers on that because I did the analysis. A couple years ago, you may recall there was a fatal in Miami, in the Miami area, where a pilot landed on A1A, 172. He had an engine failure along the beach and he did a 180 and landed on the highway. And the airplane had a head-on. Basically, it ripped off a wing and it caught fire. And I think there was one fatality, minor injury in one of the cars. So I did a video on it. And the point of the video was that he should have ditched in the water. It would have been a higher survival rate. I still believe that. But several people asked me, well, what is it for roads in general compared to fields? So I researched it and looked at a lot of accidents, and that was the only fatality I found for a road landing. All of the road landings that were in the NTSB, and they only get into the NTSB if there's damage or an injury, none of them were fatal, but there were very few of them. But I knew there were a lot, so I started to research news archives. And I found bunches of them, and none of them were fatal. And these pilots were landing in just unbelievably adverse circumstances. Some of them landing at rush hour. One of them put a 206 full of skydivers on the Atlantic City Expressway on Memorial Day. Everybody walked, bent up the airplane, probably totaled it, but nobody was injured. Some of the cars got bent, got roofs damaged or some significant damage, but cars are meant to be crashworthy, and they are. So that's why I picked the road to make a point, is that the numbers are with you. There may be cars down there. You may not know what exactly is there, things you can't see, power lines, the whole lot of it. But when you look at the totality of the results, high probability of surviving.
Were you able to compare that to other off-airport landings?
I did, and it gives a really distorted picture. More people die in landings attempted in open fields and in forests than they appear to on roads. And it's a little counterintuitive, but that's what the numbers and the accident pattern reveal.
Now, so everybody else is going for the field. Everybody agrees that that's just objectively the best thing here, regardless of the briefing. But I do want to go back to the briefing. And I'm hearing that these briefings depend on very specific circumstances, right? And it's not enough to just have this rote takeoff briefing. Above X altitude, I'll do this. Above Y altitude, I'll do this. So on this particular takeoff, there are very few options. Bruce, you mentioned the specific circumstances for takeoff briefings. Would you have briefed, for example, this field or these roads or, you know, anything to do with an early turnout, or what might you have studied in advance?
Yeah, I certainly would have taken a look around using whatever tools, you know, I had available to see what were my options right after takeoff. But I want to go back even a little bit further. There's a little quirk in this scenario in that this pilot accepted an intersection takeoff. Now, he had 5,500 feet of runway. That's more than enough for a Swift. But often we, as pilots, think we're going to save a bunch of time by not taxiing all the way to the end, or doing these other things to sort of shave off time here and there. It really doesn't add up to very much. And now he's cut way back on his options, because if he had taken off with the full length, maybe he would have had to wait for those jets to depart and wait for wake turbulence and everything. But then if that engine had quit, he might have had runway or at least airport environment still ahead of him. So think hard about accepting a intersection takeoff, even when your aircraft performance, you know, doesn't really require the full length.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay, now the other thing that could possibly save the day here is a little bit of troubleshooting, but there's not much time to do that. You maybe have time for one or two things. Let me give this to you, Steve. You're going for the field. Are you going to do anything on this 0360 to try to make it come back to life?
Not a damn thing. You know, I'm also a glider instructor. And just by way of background for those not familiar, an aerotowed glider, generally speaking, we regularly practice rope breaks from 200 feet. In the motor gliders that I teach in, we'll come back from 350 feet. Your briefing matters. For example, push 5-5, right turn, land downwind this runway. Really simple, basic, choppy statements that your lizard brain can understand, because that's who's going to be flying in an actual emergency. I mean, anybody can be taught to bring an aerotow glider back from 200 feet after they get used to the amount of chlorophyll in the windshield. But it amazes me how often I can goof them up by breaking the rope or failing the engine at 400 feet or 600 feet. All of a sudden, the helmet fire just starts up, and if there's any variability, adrenaline levels are going to be higher, surprise factor is going to be higher, you need to do exactly one or two things. And the specificity of your brief is important. Case in point, I take off from an airport with parallel runways in a motor glider. The wind's coming from the left, but there's also the parallel with a Falcon departing or landing on that runway. Now I really need to tailor that brief as to whether I'm going to go left, going to go right. I want to turn into the wind if I can. If you can be that specific, and if you are sure that you can trust yourself, your lizard brain, to do exactly as you briefed, then fine. Otherwise, I think the landing more or less ahead, not trying to troubleshoot anything, and that frankly needs to be a part of your brief. I might look down and find out, you know, whether I snag my sleeve on the mix or something really stupid. Otherwise, it is push, get the airspeed, put the aircraft into a place where, I think it was Bob Hoover who said, land it on the softest, least expensive thing you can, going as slowly as possible. I do not have time to make a plan and then deal with the emergency. So I hope that hasn't rambled too much, but you can tell I've got strong feelings about what happens at low altitude. Get the aircraft down.
There has to be some point where some amount of troubleshooting to bring the engine back to life is appropriate, gliders aside and motor gliders aside from that, I suppose. You know, and often there's most planes, there's a handful of key things that it might be. Usually it's one thing, like, you know, suppose you land in the field here, everything goes all right, and you find out that it was a misfiring mag and just switching to a single mag would have saved the day. Or it's not the case here, but, you know, carb heat could have done it, or fuel selector or whatever. Do any of you have like a really abbreviated troubleshooting checklist where there's like, I'm going to do this one thing or these two things and then I'm done below a certain altitude?
I think the situation in this scenario is the engine is violently shaking, yeah, and the pilot has noticed that the airplane is decelerating. There isn't much I don't think you can do to fix violently shaking. Perhaps the mags, as you suggested, but this thing is coming apart, and he's already lost his power. But what I want to talk about a little more is we're all well aware of the, you know, the great desire we have as pilots to get back on that airport, because somehow we know things will be just really good if we can get back to the airport. And we know that the fatality statistics tell us that's usually a pretty bad decision. And it's the natural thing. One of the fellows I knew a long time ago that was a pretty smart pilot said, we should be more like the birds. When the man is frightened, he goes for the ground. And when birds are frightened, they fly away. Now, our scenario pilot can't fly away, but we somehow think if we can just get back to that hard surface, we're going to save this airplane and everything. And the fact is, that usually doesn't turn out as good as doing what Dave suggested, and that's landing in the field with the gear up.
Bruce, Dave's response brought up a number of really excellent points, which I would summarize by saying something that I was taught years ago and I try to impress upon students, which is, in this type of scenario, how you land is more important than where you land. And that is minimum speed, as much as possible, wings level, under control. And you can survive most of these scenarios if that's the circumstances in which you reach the ground. This desire to get back to the runway, first of all, it can lead you astray. You know, maybe in this situation, you would be able to get back to the airport property where there's probably some grass or ramp space, or we even mentioned perhaps a taxiway, which wouldn't work in this circumstance. But, you know, find a space that's, even if it's a relatively small space, but it's relatively flat, clear of obstacles, put it down. Don't try to get to the runway, could perhaps be a lifesaver here.
And gear up always if it's not
a runway?
Well,
that's a tough one. But yeah, Dave made some really excellent points about gear up, especially going into a field. You don't really know how rough that field is, and especially an airplane like a Swift. I've seen lots of videos of things like RVs where they flipped on landing because the gear were down. And certainly in my Bonanza, if I were in this situation, even though I only need about 4 seconds to extend the gear in my 28-volt Bonanza, I probably would leave them up and just put the airplane down, because that's going to just give you more stability as you land, for all the reasons Dave mentioned.
Tom?
Yeah, to answer your question about is there an altitude, and have you thought about an altitude where you would begin to do some troubleshooting, and I think it is very situational kind of thing. If you've identified your landing place and feel you can make it there, and you at that point are navigating toward it and have enough mental capacity left to do a bit of quick troubleshooting, fuel pump, mags, mixture, and changing tanks, all those kind of things that we're all taught. I mean, that's fine. But if you look at the images from the resources here and see how low you are to the ground, you realize that at this altitude, you haven't time for none of that, because you have not yet confirmed that you're going to even make it to that landing point. So this is not a time to do troubleshooting, as Steve was saying. This is a time to really focus on just managing airspeed and getting the airplane over to the landing area. The interesting thing here is it's a little hard to tell here how much residential there is among those trees, but you do have some options if you needed to put it in the tops of the trees, again, in a very controlled manner with the gear up. That also would likely be rather survivable if you just couldn't make it over there to the field.
Yeah, we know Paul doesn't care about residential areas, right?
Well, you know, not to be too cynical about it, but what are you trying to get out of this? You're trying to get your own survival. You don't want to endanger anybody else. And as I said, my research in the on road landings found that the worry about that is not zero, but it's somewhat overstated. In this circumstance, if you look at the if the resources are accurate and give a true picture of what you see out the windshield, you've got a challenge to get to that field and to get set up and configured to get into it. So the chances are probably reasonably good that you're going to wind up short in the trees. And if you do, if you slow the airplane down, and this thing has, what, a 43 mile an hour stall speed? Is that what it was?
Full flaps, yeah. But yeah, at some point, you've got to, the hydraulic flaps, at some point, you've got to pump the flaps down. And
you got to get them down, because that's going to be decisive in your survival. Because I think there was a 20 mile an hour difference in stall versus clean. That's a lot. And so in this case, there's a little difficulty there. And you got to get the flaps down. It's going to take a few seconds to do that. And that may cause you to come up short. Well, be ready for it. Just slow the airplane down. Get it as slow as you possibly can. And your chances of surviving are excellent. It's not 100%, but very high. And that's true on the road, too. So, you know, if you're landing on the road, you got traffic, you got obstacles or whatever. If you're slow, slow it down. Even in an airplane that's probably not very crashworthy, as a Swift I'm sure isn't, chances of survival are excellent. Because when we look at all the emergency landings that go wrong, two things stand out: too little speed and too much speed. The too little speed is a stall spin. So people lose track of airspeed and energy and stall it and spin it before they even reach the field. And the other is too much speed, where they land and flip the airplane or overshoot and end up in trees or whatever kinds of obstacles, because there's just too much energy there. So the thing I always did in emergency landings was to teach getting the airplane really slow and being comfortable with it. And doing that in normal landings too, because I think most pilots tend to land normal landings too fast. They're too worried about stall, and so then they throw on an extra 5 knots, for margin, a couple knots for the wife and kids, and before you know it, you're 10 knots too fast, and that makes a huge difference in landing performance.
Yeah, and the Swift has a canopy. You really don't want to be upside down here. You mentioned crashworthiness. What are some of the things that you should, if you're looking at 60, 70 year old airplanes that make a plane crashworthy, what are some of the things that you can do to make it more crashworthy?
Seat belts mainly. Other than that, yeah. And if you've my Cub has aftermarket shoulder harnesses, and it complicates flying it because you can't reach the carb heat. So I have this little stick to reach the carb heat, but one of my partners used to fly it without the shoulder harnesses, and he could reach the car. I said, man, that's really just crazy. And the Cub, pre-Super Cub, is horrible because it has that overhead structure across the where the spar goes that tends to collapse into the cockpit when it's on impact. So the Cub is just horrible, and I can't imagine the Swift is any better. Never flown one, but from what I've seen them, I don't think they were designed at all with crashworthiness in mind.
Yeah, I don't know that any of us here are experienced Swifties, but
have you flown one, Dave?
Yeah, I've flown one, but just a minimum amount, and the one that I flew was highly modified with all the things people do with bigger engines and constant speed prop sort of thing. I think Tom really brings up an excellent point with what to do in preparation for, the diagnosis and fixing the problem. But, when I look at that same image that he brought up, I think I'd be hard pressed to turn the fuel off and the electricity off and do the other, pre-off-field landing things that, that we would normally do in an off-field situation. And, to Bruce's point about it's less important where you land than how you land, I think that's totally true in this situation. You know, that minimizing the ground speed by pointing it into the wind, and regardless if it the road as Paul advocates or the field as the rest of us are talking about, as long as you don't go directly into a brick wall, this accident is going to be survivable to the pilot.
Or dip a wing and, you know, cartwheel or something like that.
Tom.
Yeah, I just wanted to go back and reiterate a point that Bruce made regarding intersection takeoffs. Interestingly, we were talking about Providence here. I took off from Quonset State Airport just a couple of weeks ago, which is just a few miles south of Providence. And the immediate response from the controller was an intersection takeoff. It's a 7,500-foot runway, and I accepted it. But as I was climbing out, I had the thought of, that was stupid. I should have taxied down to the end because it was like 2,500-foot intersection takeoff that would have bought me more time. And so I think in my personal flying now, I'm going to make a decision that I'm not going to accept intersection takeoffs just because I've seen too many situations where that runway behind you really could have been useful in potentially getting either back to the airport or into a better place.
Yeah, Dave perhaps can add to this, but I know he was part of the experiments that AOPA ran on these turnback type scenarios in a variety of aircraft, including a Bonanza. And he found, as I recall, that the Bonanza, because of its speed and its climb rate, it was pretty much impossible to get back, even at an altitude you might have, you know, really thought you could do it. And of course, this is type specific on the type of airplane, the wind comes into factor and so forth. But perhaps, Dave, you could address, since you were involved in that experiment, some of the lessons learned from that.
You know, I practiced the turnbacks in that video in a A36 Bonanza. In fact, it was Tom Haines's A36 Bonanza and my own RV4. And the experience to me just reinforced how dicey a runway turnback is. You know, in the Bonanza, I wasn't even close. In the RV4, I was close. But even still, I think I was 2 out of 3 in the RV4, but never by much. And you know, what that practice really left me walking away with was how unrealistic this practice really is. Because, you know, we knew it was coming. What we had was 100% healthy engine that we then simulated a total failure in. And I think that real life tends to be messier than that. And an engine that's going to fail or partially fail is unlikely to be making 100% power, you know, during the takeoff roll and initial climb. So, you know, where we practice, say, climbing to 1,000 feet and then turning back, in reality, an engine that's making, say, 70% power, by the time it gets to that 1,000-foot altitude, is going to be much further down range. So the experience we've had practicing with 100% healthy engine climbing to 1,000 feet is really not applicable in that sort of situation. So you know, practice is great. Thinking about these sort of scenarios is super helpful, but let's admit that the practice that we do is probably unrealistic.
Practicing the turnback maneuver at altitude is of course the only way we can all safely practice it. But there's one thing missing from doing that, and that is it's a comment Steve made. You don't have all that grass in the windshield when you're turning back, and when the turnback actually happens at a low altitude, pilots are reluctant to put that nose down as far as they need to maintain the speed, and that's part of what contributes to the stall spin. So you can practice it at altitude and you can get very comfortable with it, but the picture is going to be different if it's real life.
Yeah, one of the reasons that we picked the Swift is because not a lot of people have experience with it, so we could kind of just take the pilot in this scenario's word for what they came up with. But what do you make, Dave, of the way the pilot came up with these numbers, practicing at altitude and then doing a few down low? Is there any, if you were checking yourself out in a Swift, would you do anything similar?
You know, I don't find any fault with the pilot's methodology in the practice. And I think that, you know, that building some sort of fudge factor time is smart and realistic. But it's like the assumption that the plane is going to be climbing in a healthy manner to reach the turn back altitude is, to me, faulty. You know, I don't think that's the way things work in the real world.
Yeah, that's the key takeaway I think that I'm hearing from this discussion is that this all depends on very specific circumstances, and you should brief as much as possible for the specific circumstances of a departure, but then realize that no matter what you do, you're still probably going to have to make snap decisions in the moment sometime. Be aware of the bias to try to come back to the airport. You know, stick to the key principles. It matters how you land more than where you land. Turn into the wind, fly it all the way, touchdown as slowly as you can, and you'll probably be all right.